Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadmore. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
You are getting very sleepy. Hello.
Hi, we're doing a hypnosis episode.
We
right?
are. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not going to work. I have low hypnotizability. Yeah, I actually did part of my, just as a complete aside from what we're getting into. I did part of my master's thesis on hypnotizability related features.
Oh, cool.
I can't really talk about hypnotism all that much, but I could talk about fantasy proneness all day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So welcome everyone to our season of pseudoscience. It's our year of clickbait.
Year of clickbait. Part three. Pseudoscience.
So we've talked a little bit about what pseudoscience is, and we're going to kind of continue our journey into pseudoscience by getting into psychological pseudoscience or pseudopsychology.
Mm-hmm.
Talked a little bit about parapsychology. We talked a bit about graphology. I'm really worried about the big coming after us now. I launched that on Twitter, and I was like, some graphologist is going to like come across it and they're going to be real upset.
You big dip too hard, Daniel.
Yeah. I was trying to think of something like your catchy wings melted. Yeah. Yeah. You can't really go up against the big and do very well. But we did. Odds are they're never going to listen to it. Or they will. I don't think there's any in between. Like, no one's going to listen to that and be like, I 100% agree with the big people.
I think we just write a Vox article about getting canceled by the big British Institute of Graphology.
Yeah.
Big graphology's out to get us.
That would be an interesting twist to this whole thing.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we invite them on the podcast.
I mean, it would be funny because like they would probably be like, oh, okay, yeah, and then like not realize that we did an episode on them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we're gonna continue this foray into pseudopsychology, and we're gonna talk about hypnotism and phrenology, probably two of the biggest. I guess like maybe we should start with that. Are they pseudopsychologies?
I mean, I put these two in like kind of a special category. Like, we talked about the categories of pseudoscience a while back, and like, I don't know, at least for phrenology, I kind of put this in with like Freudian psychoanalysis. Like,
yeah,
you did what you could with what you had in the Victorian era, or even before, actually. This is like
right.
The 1700s when phrenology started emerging.
Yeah.
Like, good on y'all. Like, y'all, it was definitely like a materialist, like empirical, like investigation, like very Enlightenment. Good for y'all. But like, we outgrew it.
Right. Yeah. And much like Freudian psychoanalysis, like, they've evolved, and there's mm-hmm. What does exist of like psychodynamic research is
very
much
different.
right yeah that what worked stuck around, what didn't is now lost to the annals of history.
Mm-hmm.
And phrenology is right up there with it. Hypnotism is a little weirder though.
Yeah, hypnotism seems to be like, it seems like hypnotism just gets a bad reputation because of like media portrayals of it, and demonstrating what it's not, and that lives in the popular imagination. But like the practice of hypnotism in like a clinical situation seems to be very different than what we are kind of expecting when we watch like movies or TV shows and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I mean, like, besides the whole like satanic panic use of hypnotism, and when you had that huge swath of therapists wanting to get popular by bringing out people's repressed memories through hypnotism.
Mm-hmm.
But how it's used today is much, much different than that. No one's legitimately using hypnotism to like bring out regressed past lives. Or
I know a couple people who have done that, and it's some crazy stuff.
Right. Well, like, I'm saying it's no legitimate therapist.
Right. Yeah. No. A therapist is not going to look at your past lives to determine what's wrong with you in this one.
No, but like it does work when we're talking about like someone wants to use hypnotism to lose weight or to stop smoking or but like there have to be some like specific things in place for it
right.
to work.
I have, and I think you said you would cite this. This is a article I found and used for my memory and cognition class this semester. The myths and misconceptions of hypnosis and suggestion. And they're pretty clear about what it's good for and what it's not. They do a pretty systematic look. So like they say that the average client receiving cognitive behavioral therapy augmented by hypnosis reported greater improvement than clients without hypnosis.
Cool.
There's some metadata associated with, let's see, chronic pain, irritable bowel syndrome, psychosomatic disorders, surgical or medical patients, nausea and vomiting for chemotherapy patients, needle-related pain and distress in children, favorable results in treating depression, obesity, and post-traumatic stress disorder, mixed results in treating insomnia, and preliminarily positive findings in treating smoking.
And this is with therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is with like therapy. They're like super clear that you don't just do hypnosis. Like,
right.
You do hypnosis in tandem with CBT or, you know, they're still psychoanalysts. So like maybe you're seeing a psychoanalyst that's using this for your like body image stuff for your obesity. Like,
right.
Whatever.
Yeah, my limited understanding of it, like outside of what we've been delving into, is that like it kind of like with a lot of things in therapy and in certain medical fields, that it has to have, there's some efficacy issues, so you have to believe that it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of believe in hypnotism for it to, or and you kind of have to want it to work. So you can't really be hypnotized into doing anything that you don't want to do. This isn't like media portrayal where you know, Manchurian candidate someone through like a couple of hypnosis therapy sessions to go out and like hurt someone when they don't want to do that. I mean, like probably the, you know, my favorite portrayal of hypnosis is Office Space, where he goes into this deep hypnosis like trance and like the doctor's gonna get him, wants to get him out of it, but the doctor has a heart attack. So his therapist has a heart attack and like he never comes out of that like super chill tranquil mindset of like hypnotism, and then kind of like goes about his life and he's just like, yeah, I don't care. Like he just kind of blows off his bosses, starts living life to the fullest, and like doesn't really work like that.
Yeah, no, it does. That seems to be like the key thing, at least in this article, was that like this is in the context of receiving therapy. So if you're going to therapy for like your post-traumatic stress disorder, then you do have some belief that you can work on that and be successful in that. And if you have good rapport with your like therapist who suggests hypnosis, then
right,
it'll probably work out for you. It also seems to do, one of the things I'm noticing here is that these are a lot of like, it seems like hypnosis is like a reframing technique or like a, the suggestibility is kind of a providing someone with an avenue to reframe past experiences, beliefs, memories, things like that. Like you said, with the Satanic Panic, like people were creating real false memories about like receive, like being the victim of satanic ritual abuse.
Right.
And so
Like, if you're going there because, like, you want to quit smoking and you have this belief that you can't quit or whatever, then the hypnosis could be an aid to, like, really unmoor that central belief and, like, start twisting it around in new ways that might be more helpful.
Yeah, and I mean much of the same way why like people will believe those thoughts. And I mean, if you have that belief in efficacy and your therapist is like, you saw this thing and you have this thing and here's this fantastic thing that happened to you, you just sort of ingrain it as like the same way we ingrain normal false memories. Doesn't actually change behavior. Doesn't actually like it's not really the hypnosis that's doing that. It's the therapist in that case, or the supposed therapist.
The supposed therapist. That was something interesting that was in this article, was that kind of like building off of your example that the therapist died, so the guy was stuck in the
Yeah.
hypnotic state. There really isn't, like, it does not take an expert to do hypnosis. Like, there is
Right.
no hypnotism expertise in the sense of, like, there's people who've been doing it a long time and have lots of experience, but there was one study that they talked about that people with no skill and no experience performing a hypnotism before performed just as well as the like quote unquote experts. And so it's not really something that, like, you have to have this person bring you in and back out, or like you have to go to this hypnotist. Like, if someone has, like, knows how to do it, then they're just as good as anybody else who can do it.
I mean, it's like a belief thing. Like, you just have to fake it till you make it if you're one of the hypnotists, it seems like. It's just the people have to believe that you can do it. Again, I will say this every episode at least once. We are in the wrong line of work.
We are. I could, like, do a. We could do like a hypnotism, put out some crystals, read some tarot cards, and then study ghosts and if people are doing telepathy.
Yeah. Do some
Ooh, can
like
people do telepathy better if they're hypnotized?
what's the one with the writing? It's like distance writing or something like that. This idea that like you can like sit down. It's like a form of like telepathy or precognition that people claim that they sit down in like a room and they just write and they write like future predictions and stuff like that.
Oh, like automatic writing?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Automatic writing, and it's also called psychography.
That's what we need to do. Let's do a psychography study.
A psychography study,
Does
yeah.
hypnosis improve? But we have to keep it grounded in science. So does hypnosis improve perception of like psychography efficacy?
Yeah, and we could do like different levels, like conditions. So, like, one condition is like the Confederate is thinking the thing that you need to write in the other room,
Yeah.
and then like the next condition is like you need to channel like the spirit of your dead grandma to bring us a message.
Or what if like the person that you're channeling is hypnotized? Does that
Ooh.
open them up? Does the belief of the person who's doing the psychography, does it open them up? See, I
Yeah,
love
we could.
that as a thought experience.
That would be so fun.
And that's real science. We're looking at like individual perception of their own abilities. Doesn't matter if those abilities are realistic or not, based on other social and environmental factors. Like, so you could study this stuff. But that takes more work than just bringing some people in a room and trying to prove psychography. Well, yeah. So I guess like to touch on that, like there is a grain of truth to hypnotism. It does work for people.
And it does seem to be a separate conscious state than other conscious states. So it's not relaxation, it's not
Right.
sleep, and it's not mindfulness.
You think like this makes me think like thinking about how like where we see efficacy with hypnosis, it makes me think of EDMR. Right? EMDR, eye movement.
EMDR, EDMR, electronic dance music rave.
No. the eye movement, like rapid desensitization. That's not quite that letter combination, something like that. But it's fascinating because like every researcher who's like looking at it is like, this is all BS. Like, this doesn't hold up. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And then they'll run some studies and be like, oh, it helps people.
Mm-hmm.
How? Well, it helps people. But it's like it's paired with therapy. It tends to focus on having you like follow a finger or follow like some sort of signal, or you know, it sounds like hypnotism.
It does sound like hypnotism. Are they the same thing? Are you inducing a hypnotic state with the rapid eye movement therapy? Is it rapid eye movement therapy? REMD?
REM, yeah, something like that. It's not rapid eye movement because that's sleep. That's oh, REM.
Yeah, people, then it would be a sleep state.
But it's really interesting because like then maybe it would work better for someone who's like low hypnotizability. Because again, if you don't have a whole lot of efficacy in hypnotizability or in hypnotism, you're probably not going to be hypnotized. It's probably not going to have a big effect on you.
EMDR.
EMDR.
Eye movement desensitization reprocessing.
Uh-huh.
So let's see if there's a difference between that and hypnosis.
But well, it makes me think, like, because it's worded and grounded differently, could it get around that hypnotizability issue? For that person who comes in and is like, no, this is a more serious therapy. It's definitely not hypnosis. Because again, you just have to feel that it has some efficacy.
Okay, let's see. So April Yawn, psychotherapyboulder.com. So we know it's legit because it's in Boulder,
that
Colorado.
Super legit.
Says that during hypnosis, a state of mental relaxation is employed to tap into the conscious mind. EMDR, on the other hand, attempts to gently connect with an anxious mental state. Hypnosis assists you in maintaining one highly focused state. Oh, God, all the ads. I don't need your help, April. I just want to read your words. Highly focused state where you can receive and accept new ideas. EMDR allows you to maintain a dual focus by addressing your beliefs in a more positive manner while dealing with problematic memories.
All right, we're going to have to come back to that one.
That's
I'm going to have to do more reading on EMDR.
Oh, it's April Lyons. Not... Oh, there's two L's in the URL. That's why. Oh, there's a lot of LPCs, LPCCs.
I mean,
LMSWs in her cohort.
It's quite popular. It's growing in popularity. But yeah, I mean, interesting. I don't know. We'll have to come back to that as a thought. I'm going to have to do some more reading on EMDR. Again, it's super fascinating. I've had some students really interested in it. And again, like even the biggest skeptics amongst the people who research it are like, no, it holds up. Like it works. Can't really argue against it. And that's good. Like that's a good hallmark. Like we may not understand how it works right now, but it works. Like it does have some efficacy. That's interesting. Yeah, so like there is this grain of truth to hypnotism, but it is very different than like the typical portrayals of hypnosis in the media or in movies, which would be the kind of the pseudoscience side of hypnosis.
Mm-hmm. If you see an ad from a dude with a beard who's like, I can hypnotize your problems away,
it's me. You should follow it. And...
it's me.
Don't do it. Valid.
Back to our like rule of thumb. If it's fast, it's probably fake.
Yeah. If you're at the ballroom of the Hilton And that there's a bunch of people there, and they're going to do a hypnosis event. It's probably not going to work. You know, unless you really, really, really believe it's going to work, then, like, it's a placebo effect. And I mean, sure, you'll get something out of it. But yeah, the then what, Thomas, like, are all the people who, I don't know if your Myths of Hypnosis article talks about like the people who quack like a duck or according to cues, like, act a certain way on stage when, like, this magician hypnotizes them. They're not like actors in the audience, are they? Or
they couldn't be.
No.
Why would you say that?
What? I mean, they seem to be random people selected. I don't know. Is there some efficacy to it?
I'm gonna guess no, that there isn't. Unless there's, like, some sort of like you said, like, the person in the audience is, like, a true believer. But they would, the thing with the hypnosis, though, is that people remember the hypnotic state. So the thing that's fake, so they could be quacking like a duck, but the thing that would be fake is them not remembering that they quack like a duck, because they would remember it.
Right. Yeah. Cause it's not a completetly blank, like, it's still consciousness.
Like, you're still aware, and, like, even this article says that people still remember periphery details. So, like, they, like, patients can recall like, phone conversations happening in another room while they're under hypnosis. So, like, it's not even like a flow state where you, like, block off periphery details. It's, like, more open than that. And so you would remember, and you would be conscious, and you would know what's going on. So I don't, like, they might could quack like a duck because they're a true believer and there's high suggestibility there. But if there's any sort of act afterwards that they don't remember that they did the thing, then I'm going to guess that it's a fake.
So there's this old question. It's like 9 years old on Quora.
Okay.
But the person who answered it is got, you know, a bunch of answers and stuff, and is noted as an apprentice hypnotist, or was 9 years ago. He posted this, but someone asked, like, do magicians really hypnotize people? And he says that it is, like, a real phenomenon. Like, it is supported, and I'll agree with that. And said that some people are more susceptible to it than others. So usually for that reason, a magician will, like, start with a group of people and narrow it down until he finds, like, the right one. And it says, if you see a magician just take one person out of the audience and hypnotize them directly, they either A, have worked with that person before, and likely hypnotize them, or it's not hypnotism, it's a magic trick dressed up as hypnotism, or if it's on TV, then they're just showing you the best clips.
Yep.
And I was like, yeah, cool, that's great. It's not mind control. It could be suggestive, like, the person's going to play along with it, but yeah, they're definitely going to remember it, or this is definitely someone that they've worked before. I also love this person's comment, just because I need to say this. The debate exists both in the scientific literature as well as the magical literature.
Makes sense.
It's great. Yeah, magician literature.
Magician literature. Yeah, now, I mean, I could see theoretically that somebody might quack like a duck outside of their conscious will, but that's in, like, a social conformity kind of thing. Like, if you're in the crowd and this is your favorite magician that you spent hours watching on YouTube, and then you're the one who's chosen, and then you get hypnotized successfully, then there's high suggestibility, high expectation from the group for you to perform that action, and then also a self-confirmation bias to, like, or is that a self-confirmation bias? That, like, you personally need that magician's hypnotism to work.
Yeah,
so you are gonna quack.
Yeah, and I'd imagine too that, like, if it's a whole hypnotism act, they probably, like, start with one or two people that they've worked with before. And again, you again create that efficacy and you set things up, and there's probably like with people who do cold readings, like a lot of them aren't cold readings, they're hot readings where they've got, like, you know, the they've got people embedded in the crowd before the show, and they're recording and listening in on like what people are saying, you know. So that person in the you know, the entryway is like, I really hope I get to talk to my dead father. And then they're like, I'm gonna talk about that. I'm gonna channel their parent, or, you know, they have that kind of inside information. We don't have cold reading. We need a squeeze like cold reading.
Do what we need a what?
We should like squeeze like cold reading in to one of our episodes and talk about like people who commune with the dead.
Well, I mean, I can give a good, like, this has been an absolutely fantastic, let me see if I can find it. I've been listening to an audiobook while I play Minecraft this semester.
Ooh. Okay.
And it's called, let's see, it's called Confessions of a Spirit Medium.
Ooh.
Or Spirit Medium audio book. Let's see, I totally lost it. It's done by LibriVox. Oh, Revelations of a Spirit Medium by A Medium. And this bad boy came out in, let's see, when did it come out? 1922. And it was one of the, like, inspirations for Houdini.
Oh.
Because Houdini was, like, an avid, like, opponent of spirit mediumship and, like, spiritualist societies.
Yeah.
And so this is what inspired him to go on that.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Really cool book. But it goes through and talks about how these spiritualist societies were kind of like set up like cults a little bit. Because on the front end, it was like people in the community. And then on the back end, there was the spirit medium, like, state network. And so as people were inducted into the spirit mediumship, there was like a ton of resources for these people to do hot readings in different towns that they'd never been to along train routes.
So you would show up in the town and there'd be someone in that town who did work in other towns. And they would get, oh, that's fascinating.
And they'd be like, hey, you're going to this event at this person's house. They always want to talk to so-and-so. These people will be there. These are the people that have recently died in their lives. Here are the newspaper clippings. And then they would take notes while they were in these houses that were holding these events, and then give those notes back to the person along with the file. So that way the next spirit medium could pick it up and use it to craft their next.
That is fascinating.
Yes. So. Way cool. It's like, I'll send you the link to this so we can post it with this.
Yeah,
episode too.
Yeah, yeah. We don't have to talk about it. Go and listen to this audiobook. It'll be our plug.
Forewarning. Yeah. 1922 sentiment.
Oh yeah, there's probably a bunch of terrible stuff in there.
A bunch of terrible things in there, like surprisingly sexist things in there. Like, I was expecting, so in the spiritualist societies at the time, men were the dominant spirit mediums.
Well, that makes sense.
And so there's lots of, like, there's never been a good woman spirit medium, blah, blah, blah. They're all terrible and never trust them and all sorts of crazy shit like that.
Wow. I mean, we're obviously
all thieves, they're the worst.
Yeah, they're terrible. We're scamming people across the country.
Yeah,
it's just because they were trying to cut in on the, you know, their action. So.
So, no, I'll share this. It's been a great listen.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's other stuff out there, too. Like, people like, was it John Edwards? The guy who became really popular? There's a couple of them. Like, yeah, like, they have a number of these, like, they had TV shows. A number of these, like, famous mediums and stuff. So,
well, the only medium that I trust is Teresa Caputo, the Long Island medium. And she can tell me anything.
All right. So the Long Island medium seems to have some efficacy, and hypnotism seems to have some efficacy. Let's talk about something that has no efficacy, like, or shouldn't have any efficacy.
I have with phrenology.
Yeah.
Let me just say, first of all, it is found in my psychic sciences book.
I mean,
from the 1970s.
I would hope it is.
And you can find it between palmistry and physiognomy.
Well, because it's in alphabetical order, right?
Which is the character analysis from the head, face, and other features. So it's all like body part divination.
Yeah, so...
It's also between two cigarette ads. Because it's an old book.
That's fantastic.
Let these three wise men into your home. That's one of the catchphrases for these cigars.
All right. So, phrenology.
Phrenology.
So hypnotism is mesmer, and that's like 17th century, 1700s, 1600s. Mesmer.
Mesmer.
That's
why we call it mesmerize.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where it comes from.
All sorts of new things tonight.
That's fantastic. I didn't realize you didn't know that.
I didn't know that. That's so cool.
Phrenology is Franz Gall. And this is like late 1700s, early 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was picked up by Johann Spurzheim. And they're trying to correlate behavior with skull shape.
Mm-hmm.
So not parts of the brain, that comes later, not connections, not nature or nurture, skull shape.
Skull shape.
Yeah,
it's all about the bones.
So Gall published his work between 1810 and 1819.
Okay.
In four volumes, The Anatomy and Physiology of the Nervous System in general and of the brain in particular. I love these old names. They're just so much. It's The Anatomy and Physiology of the Nervous System in general and of the brain in particular, with observations on the possibility of discovering the number of intellectual and moral dispositions in men and animals through the configurations of their heads.
Beautiful.
That's the full title.
That's the full title.
That's the full title. And there are four volumes.
Oh. Wordy.
Yeah.
Was Franz Gall.
I mean, yeah, they all were. The more words you have, the more legitimate it is.
Wordsmiths.
Yeah, Alchemists, so he found
of their time.
So he's got 27 different cranial areas. Overlying specific and separate brain organs. I'm going to post the link to this article. This is the New Phrenology, because it talks about Gall, but then it goes off on tangents, because it's like, no. We don't talk about Gall anymore, because he's been pretty much discredited. It was very popular. Fervent believers include Mark Twain, Edgar Allan Poe, Walt Whitman, the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb, Sarah Josepha Hale, and celebrities such as Clara Burton, Joseph Smith, had their heads measured and assessed by phrenologists, and President James Garfield was a believer. If you had a reason not to think too highly of James Garfield, he was a phrenologist, or a believer in phrenology.
So pretty much all of our moody romantic poets were phrenologists.
Yes. Oh, this is great. So the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb, this Sarah Hale, was the editor of the Godey's Ladies book, which was the most popular women's magazine in America during the mid-19th century. She claimed that, quote, phrenology was second only to Christianity as a force for the elevation and improvement of the status of women.
Wow.
It's a bold claim.
Wow. Get your heads measured.
Yeah.
Forget the ankles.
Yeah, you get your head measured. It shows how great you are. Which I'm probably like, if we're talking about like old school 19th century phrenologists, they're probably up there with like early 20th century eugenicists and are like, well, women's heads are smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably says something to the phrenologist. And like, again, we're talking like 19th century, so very sexist.
Eugenics hasn't really like kicked off in full swing yet.
Right.
But it's definitely laying some like foundational work there. I did some quick searching, and there is a difference between craniology and phrenology. And so craniology is the comparative study of skulls,
okay,
between humans. And then phrenology is the, what is it, the ratio of skull sizes of an individual and then inferring these personality and behavioral traits.
How are we on craniology on this podcast?
How are we? Do we like it? Is it fine?
I mean,
right. Oh, well, craniology is where you get all those like old school diagrams of like the white man's skull.
Oh, yeah. See, that's what I was thinking. Like at face value, it sounds all right, but I was getting those vibes. I just wanted to double check.
Racial comparisons between the different kinds of skulls is craniology.
Yeah, so this is different. So this is distinct from that. It's not saying, hey, no, we're not talking about skull differences. We're talking about bumps and ridges and weird shapes in the skull.
It is different, but like it's still the Victorian era, so I would assume the phrenologists were also eugenicists. But like,
I mean, the phrenologists were probably also hardcore believers in like racial dimorphism and or sexual dimorphism, you know, issues in craniology and racial issues.
Yeah, I'm not gonna like say like phrenology is the pure science or the good one versus the evil craniology, but like, they're both garbage. And like, yeah. I'm even thinking about that quote from the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb. Like, that makes me think of Margaret Sanger with like, eugenics will like be the liberatory thing for women. So like, okay.
Yep. Yeah, it's just, this is the big thing. We gotta hope that it will help us. But it did not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
they were like, I don't know, very Enlightenment progressive camps for their time, right? They did like buck, like the implications of phrenology are like the inbred ruling classes have like messed up heads. Like, why are we letting them rule?
Sure. Yeah.
So like it could be used in that way for that time, right? But
it wasn't. I mean, well, it could be.
It wasn't, but it wasn't. Could have been. There was some libertary seeds in there that they could have, you know, tilled.
So, I mean, in short, like, this is one of those things where, like, it doesn't really hold up. Whereas, like, there is this, like, grain of truth in hypnotism that allows us to utilize it within psychology in some way. Phrenology, probably the only way that it's been kind of utilized is kind of a step to better understanding of not the skull but the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Is that once we get to that point of technology where we can start studying the brain, we can say, well, look, phrenology doesn't hold up, but you know, like this part of the brain's associated with memory, and this is part of the brain's associated with vision, and this part of the brain's associated with motor movement.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is what Stern in this article gets at. Robert Stern talks about the new phrenology, is that we're kind of regressing back to a very phrenological view of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're almost becoming hyper-focused in some fields with finding that particular part of the brain that explains everything about X. This part is the trauma center, and this part is the you know, the center that if it's off by a little bit, you're going to be a sociopath. And in this part of the brain, like is going to determine whether or not you have like high musical aptitude without taking into things like the environment and learning and how different parts of your brain interact with one another. We kind of got there and said like, yeah, this big part in the back of my brain is the occipital lobe. It's tied to vision in a number of different ways. And then like we were where we needed to be, like past phrenology. And then we were like, but if we start using these fMRIs, we're back to hating on neuroscience again.
We are. It is the beginning of a spring semester, so we do need to like do our annual
Have our neuroscience episode. Yeah. Like every season.
Every season in the spring.
Our neuroscience episode.
I have this fun article. It's called The Neophrenology of fMRI that I make my grad students read, because it pretty much like tears apart this idea that you were discussing, except they bring in these examples of like the poetry centers of the brain. And so like the author writes, like, the in this lab they scanned participants while they were asked to generate poems spontaneously, and a panel of experts then read the work for technical facility and innovation. The ultimate finding was the quality of poetry was associated with divergent connectivity patterns in experts and novices, centered on the mediolateral prefrontal cortex and the intraparietal sulcus. For innovation. They concluded that experts produced higher quality poetry. Wow.
Yeah.
That they were able to like tether poetry generation to like these are the parts of the brain that you want to develop to make good poetry.
But how do you develop those parts of the brain, Thomas?
Yeah, and what's good poetry?
I don't think anybody can answer
that question either.
Well, but maybe developing those parts of the brain comes with practicing writing poetry. And so it's not really like you're a natural at being a good poet. You practice and you get good at it and you learn from your mistakes. Yeah, I really love this, because like when we get into like the modern view of this, it's the end of his article. It's technology won't rescue faulty thinking. It's kind of the one of his other quotes is those who don't study pseudoscience are doomed to repeat it. And he says Gall, Spurzheim, and others theorize that behaviors such as phyloprogenitiveness and metaphysical spirit were generated in specific regions of the brain, and those regions could be assessed via the skull by means of careful measurements. Their theory was wrong. behavioral attributes and morals aren't generated in single specific regions of the brain. They are complex activities that require extensive global activity, initiation of thought, memory of necessary functions, assessment of the sensory inputs, memory of how to produce the motor requirements necessary to complete the acts, judgment regarding the acts, and dozens of other activities. Thinking and behaving is complicated business.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. In short, yes. It's fascinating, because we do have these aspects, tell my students like there are these things that we're likely doing today. Like if we want to take a quasi social evolutionary approach to things, which I still do on occasion, that there are some things that we can look at that it's very likely our ancestors did, or we want to understand like a bias or a heuristic, we can look back to some function it might have served in our ancestral past, and it may not be helpful for us today. Mm-hmm. Like maybe it's more helpful for us to get along as a larger collective than to engage in tribalism, but tribalism is deep-seated in a lot of ways. It doesn't mean we can't override it, but it makes me think about that with like these aspects of like these old school psych thoughts, is that we have these old ideas in psychology and we move past them, we find better ways of explaining, we find the next step, the way to kind of move into a more scientific approach, and then we turn around and we're like, yeah, but what if we found the metaphysical center of the brain? Or what if we found, like, you know, like this is the moral neuron. And it's like, it sounds
the warrior gene.
When again, it's not just that gene, it's a complex interaction of biology, genetics, environmental expression of that gene, a number of other things. But like, we're just, that's complex though. We want something simple. We want a warrior gene. We want a Bill Clinton neuron.
A Bill Clinton neuron?
It was the first thing that popped in my head. So there was a study that found that when it came to memory, like certain neurons activate for like certain like facial recognition. So like you have this like cluster that activates, or this neuron that activates when you see the president, so whoever the president is. It was Bill Clinton at the time.
Okay. I was like, what?
Right. But like
the Bill Clinton.
But it was like, it's kind of the same thing. It's like we... But like, that's a good clickbaity title for an article.
It
right?
is. It really is. No, because I'm like, what does the Bill Clinton neuron do? Not have sexual relations?
Well, no, because it's the Bill Clinton neuron. It has to do that. So, yeah, like the idea was, is like we have like a neuron that activates when we see a particular person. And that we tend to see like a similar neuron activate in everyone who recognizes that person. It may not be the same area, but it's likely because like it's a combination of that person's face or other contexts associated with that person. But it's easier for our brain to light up like one point, and that one connection or that one point says that is the retrieval. We even like when it came to like celebrity couples, they found that like as a couple, it was one neuron, but separate, it was two separate neurons because we like code the way we code things. And again, I don't know how much efficacy that is, like in a modern sense. Like, does that hold up today? It sounds
right. Yeah, I don't think it's a neuron. Like, right. That doesn't make any sense.
But like I could see cluster, like a
spreading activation of like concepts.
Yeah, maybe like it starts happening at a point. And it's going to start at us, but... you know, but yeah. Like even then, like that, it reminds me of something akin to like a new phrenology, where it sounds good. It sounds cool. That gets you your TED talk.
Right.
To do the Bill Clinton neuron. But it doesn't really hold up.
So before we transition, would you like to know how to read the skull?
Sure.
So for those of you at home, you can hit pause and grab a phrenology bust if you have one. But the main idea is that there are three different divisions in phrenology. So the region of instincts and propensities is found in the lower portion of the back of the head. The sentiments of or moral faculties occupy most of the upper portion of the head, and the abilities or intellectual faculties at the front of the head, including the forehead. And within each of these, there are different groupings that exist. So group one, and this is from, back of the head. Yeah. Very like super base of the head moving towards like the bridge of your nose. And so it goes, group one is the social proclivities. So this is going to be parental love, friendship, continuity, amicableness, things like this. Group two, vivaciousness, destructiveness, secretiveness, callousness, cautiousness. Group three is the aspiring faculties, which are going to be self-esteem and firmness, which is purpose, endurance, stability of nature, things like that. Four is the moral sentiments, and that's going to be conscientiousness, hope, spirituality, veneration, benevolence. Group five is semi-intellectual facilities, so constructiveness, ideality, Sublimity. Ooh, there's a whole part of the brain for the sublime.
Wow.
Mirthfulness. I should use the word mirth more frequently. Group six is the reasoning faculties, so causality, comparison. One's just called human nature. Shows the ability to judge people almost on sight. Excessive development is overcritical in judgment, and deficiency is a lack of discrimination in choice of friends and associates. And that's going to be region 29 for those with a phrenology bust in front of them. And agreeableness. We got some big five words getting tossed around.
Yeah, sure.
Group seven, the literary faculties. So this is going to be time as well as tune and language. And then group eight is our perceptive faculties, which is individuality, form, size, weight, color, order, calculation, and locality. Locality is when developed, this shows the urge for travel, quick adjustment to new surroundings, and the ability to remember places. And that's going to be 42 on your phrenology bust.
I love that it's in
the psychic sciences book.
Yeah, I have to ask. So you said at the beginning that one was like parental love. So if your parents love you more, there's a part of your brain that's different, or that like a part of your skull that's different than people whose parents love them less.
So originally blessed with the elaborate title of philoprogenitivinus.
I mentioned that one.
This covers both maternal instinct and filial attraction. Developed, it shows a love of children, pets, and all others needing aid or attention.
Oh, okay.
So it's not that your parents loved you, it's your capacity.
Your capacity for love.
And forgiving parental love. Yeah.
Ah, okay. The fact that I locked my dog out of my room because it was whining at me nonstop. I probably got a bit of a depression in that area tonight.
So it's the group one, region three. So that is quite literally on the back of your head where your occipital lobe is.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm feeling for. It just feels like rounded skull.
Rounded skull.
I did take a hit to that area of the head when I was a kid and had to get stitches. But that would be an environmental influence on the bumps and ridges of my skull, as opposed to actual phrenological growth.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they account for that in like theories of phrenology.
Yeah, you get hit hard enough. What happens to Phineas Gage after his accident? Like, do you have to account for that phrenology?
Right. Forgot to give him the reading beforehand and then after, and then like test the behavior before and after and see if it actually like changes those regions.
So I guess we should move to finish. Like we're hitting an hour. We should move to our ask psychology question of the week. I do have a runner up, because it was also taken down after an hour.
Damn those mods. They're quick.
You know, but it's good. It's good. It violated one of the rules. It does not say which of the rules, but I mean, I get it. I do like the question. I think it's very like pseudosciencey. What does quote low level of consciousness, what is quote low level of consciousness, and why do people, I'm not sure who these people are, claim that certain individuals are inherently evil due to them having a low level of consciousness?
Oh, this is a vibes question.
Yeah, like, so what
vibrations,
what does this mean? Is there a good read on psychology with regards if people are inherently evil, or about the whole nature versus nurture side of people being evil? As a note, by evil person, I mostly mean a person who finds joy in tormenting others. So masochist Or so sadist, right?
Sadist.
Yeah. Nonetheless, you can take it however you like if you have something more interesting in mind. So it was taken down, but there was someone who did respond with a really good answer. But I don't know. What's your thought on like low level? I don't even know what low level of consciousness means.
It sounds like some sort of like vibrations, metaphysical, new age terminology is what it sounds like. Like my vibrations are really low, so like I'm liable to thrash out because I'm hangry or something like that. Like I'm giving off bad vibes into the universe and it's like sending it back to me. That's kind of the read I'm getting. Maybe it's also like low levels of consciousness as compared to like higher levels of consciousness. And so like there's some sort of like the unenlightened are like the evil dirty masses, but like I do shrooms and so I'm like connected with Mother Gaia.
Sure.
Like that's
I mean, yeah, I
like,
okay,
if I were to unpack that, if I unpack that terminology, that's what it makes me think of. Because I don't know what, like, there really isn't, like, a psych concept of low levels of, like, what is, that we don't really have levels of consciousness. Like, there's a gradient, but also there's, like, different, like, categories of consciousness, too.
Yeah. Yeah. The only response, who has a master's of science in cognitive neuroscience, PhD in progress, is evil is not a term used in psychology. The general stance
tells Philip Zimbardo that.
Well, yeah, but like, is it? I don't want to get into whether Zimbardo is Zimbardo a modern psychologist? Well, I guess how do we define modern psychology? Like someone who still updates their research into the modern era? No, he's still talking about how boys playing video games in the basement are ruining masculinity in the world. He got a TED talk on that, because of course he did. He caught me on a roll with Zimbardo. Yeah, it's just that they say both biological and environmental factors must be present, like it is a nature and nurture thing. You don't just see biology. Maybe there's an argument that we could learn to be evil in that sense. If the environment like leads us down to like enjoying being a sadist.
I don't know. Like that's kind of the point of the dark triad though, right? It was looking at like the precursor of why do people do like terrible things.
Well, they do link articles on or Wikipedia things on psychopathy and Machiavellianism.
Mm-hmm.
So antisocial personality like disorder.
A little bit of the answer there is that like it's not called evil, it's called the dark triad.
Right. Yeah. What we call evil is a collection of spectrum-based constructs that if you're high in a number of them, you exhibit what we would consider evil traits.
Yes.
So,
but those traits are then measured by you self-reporting those evil overt behaviors that we then backwards logic to a construct existing, then to confirm it with the same self-report of external behaviors.
I'm gonna move us to our real question because that's like the like didn't hold up. They're not leaving it. I picked one that's a couple of days old. I was actually torn between because I think this one's up your alley, and I'm gonna let you choose which one.
Oh
we do.
God. Okay.
Have humans always been natural kissers? So kissing. I'll explain more if that's what you or. Why is there no concept of species identity in psychology?
Oh, we've actually talked about this in our old lab.
Maybe we'll save you want to save kissing for next week?
Yeah, let's talk about kissing next week. Because I don't know. That's like
it's an interesting question,
but also like fun little like evolutionary psych head scratcher.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I do remember now that I'm like We're having spreading activation occur.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll save it for next week. Let's talk about species identification.
Yeah. So
that's a thing.
After all, species is just a scientific concept that doesn't really quote unquote exist, but makes biology and taxonomy easy to understand. That said, isn't there something of a species quote unquote identity in our mind? And couldn't some people have a different species identity depending on environment / genetics? Before you say anything, I want to predict whether or not you're also about to say the top rated comment. So go.
Oh, I have three things that it could be.
Oh, the top rated comment is just WTF are you talking about?
Oh, okay. No, I think this is a legitimate question.
No, yes. Yeah, but so he explains the original poster, who has a fantastic username that I am not going to repeat on the air. He says, like, well, like, you go on the street and ask someone, hey, do you feel like a human? Of course they say, yeah. But human is a scientific construct. I got an issue with that. Evolution is a spectrum that's always happening, but of course, since it takes so long, we're able to observe species, quote unquote, as they are. But since it's just a construct, why isn't there sort of a way to describe species identity? That is, surely not all people feel human or feel like they want to associate with the human race. These grand speciesists, as you might call them, certainly exist, as we've seen people growing up in the wild with wolves. Have we seen people growing up in the wild and with wolves? Or the presence of furry communities.
Why
is there any recognition of this in psychology? Or maybe there is, I just don't know.
Okay, well, first of all, like, search Sharon Roberts and read her work.
Yeah. Furries, Therians, otherkin.
The Therians, otherkin, like, that is right there. And I personally feel like there's some sort of, like, late capitalist, like, dissociation with, like, the self going on there, but that's a separate story. What I think that the poster is trying to get at, and that I think is the reason why we don't have human identity, is because we don't have a humanoid outgroup to reinforce the epistemological barriers of that identity.
If a bunch of gray aliens, like as we kind of view them in media, were to land tomorrow, we would instantly develop a intense, salient human identity. We conflate it with racial identity today, mm-hmm. like, because we have salient outgroups based on physical appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can't really, like, there's like a little bit of that, I think, going on in like Christian circles of like, where like men are put in charge of like the domination of the earth kind of thing.
Yes.
I could see a little bit of that there. But to the extent of like, I personally identify as a human, like that won't happen until aliens land or like the reptile people come out of the earth's core.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, they're talking about it as a construct of like, the identity they feel in their brain, not the biological species that they are, but like, that's like, it's conflated. Like, it's the same thing. You identify mm-hmm. as who you are or who you assume or perceive yourself to be. Mm-hmm. I do like this question because at least we're social identity theorists. And so,
right. Yeah, it's perfect.
I remember we did that study. I think it kind of like quasi worked, but we needed to do follow-ups. I came up with the idea that you compare yourself to Superman, the Kal-El.
Oh, right. Like, yeah, maybe.
Salient group comparison to Kal-El or to Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne being human.
Mm-hmm.
Though, like, peak human versus Kal-El being an alien. Right.
Yeah. I wonder if this would work better. Maybe the follow-up is human versus clones.
Ooh.
clones might throw a wrench in that. Because I think maybe the identity difference then would not be like a human identity, but it would be like a natural category of human identity. You know what I mean?
Natural versus man-made, or natural versus artificial. So it wouldn't be a species identity. But I mean, like, if we still had Neanderthal running around, we would definitely have a Homo sapiens Neanderthal socialite, or, you know, salient identity split. If we had,
so there would have been one at one time.
Yes. Yeah, but it's also interesting because we know that Homo sapiens interbred with Neanderthals, and so maybe maybe the level of identity that those early hominids or our early ancestors displayed may have made them more willing to be like, yeah, whatever.
Sure, but also, have you seen the top porn results in like southern states?
True.
The exotic is erotic.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Yeah.
This isn't like a theory or anything. This is like a meme that's been tossed around. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's tries to explain. It explains the uncanny valley effect. In that, what about our like ancient ancestors?
Yeah, I love that.
Did they need to have an uncanny valley effect when they were looking at something that looked human but wasn't?
Yeah, like how would that,
how is that adaptive for them? And why does it just apply to like robots and stuff now? And so I'm wondering if like uncanny valley is like leftover like human Neanderthal interaction.
Yeah, I mean, I am kind of hung up. I mean, like, everything is a social construct, so I kind of agree with this guy saying, like, but human is a scientific construct. It's a social construct. And I'm like, yes, but we don't have a salient comparison. That would be the short answer. We don't have a salient comparison to compare our prototypical human. Though, going back to cranologists and eugenicists, they would likely argue that some people are more human than other. And I would imagine
would be like an in-group like hierarchy, right? Because they wouldn't like deny that.
It gets conflated with racial, which is also kind of, socially constructed. They would conflate that. They would likely still admit, like a hardcore eugenicist would still say, we're all human.
We're just more human than others.
Right.
I'm a bigger fan of being a human than most. I've been to more inventions.
Yeah. So like, or if maybe we had some like very intelligent animal, like if you were maybe we'd see it in like zookeepers who work with chimpanzees.
Ooh, maybe.
That if you're working more closely with more, like, and you recognize sort of a certain level of animal intelligence, you could develop that salient human identity. And so maybe you would have a higher human identity than, but like, I don't think you would get a transhumanist because, well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you find that one person who's like, I have ascended the human form. I know of one we could talk about at some point, but he's less of a pseudoscience thing and more of just like a weird guy on the internet kind of thing.
Oh, cool.
But he believes that he's like a world destroying dark entity known as like Great Dragon, or Great Black Dragon, something like that, where he's eventually going to shed his human form, this dying body that he's in, and he's going to destroy all the unworthy people. And I would bet he has a pretty low identity as human. But he might also have some sort of clinical issue that is undiagnosed or diagnosed.
So long and short of it is, you don't have a salient outgroup and you're just possibly cursed from previous human identity categories with your uncanny valley effect.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at some point we might develop a next level, or like, I don't know, we random mutation can happen.
Yeah,
it happens all the time. Maybe there'll be a random mutation distinct enough. Maybe the X-Men will happen. The X gene will activate and we will get mutants with powers. And then we should human see identity. Mutant and human. And thus we would see all of the X-Men era or the X-Men comic. You know, this is really just an allegory for civil rights and racial injustice, but with mutants instead of, we would see it play out. Because I have no hope that, like, if mutants existed, we wouldn't put them on a registry and
absolutely.
So, on that existential note, yeah. Well, until we meet aliens, maybe if we bag a Sasquatch.
Ooh,
thinking about that, yeah. Too, like,
bag a Sasquatch.
Sasquatch, I like. Well, I'm not Sasquatch, so I'm human. It makes it, I don't know, as a last thought with this, that like, I wonder too if like, if it really does become more popular, if like people better understanding whether or not, because like we are starting to understand, like we do have at least subsets of the population with more Neanderthal DNA, or like Neanderthal genealogy heritage than others, that may create some level of like Homo sapiens.
So what you're telling me is that the Mormon church who controls Ancestry.com has been putting together a registry of mutants over the past 20 years that...
Well, I mean, they're not really mutants. They're Neanderthal descendants. Maybe.
I wonder how the Mormons do, like, deal with that in their, like, post-death salvation stuff. Like, can Neanderthals be saved? Because that's why they do the ancestry, so that way they can track down their old relatives, so that way they can, like, give them post-mortem salvation stuff.
You get baptized in whatever it's called. Baptism by proxy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Like, what happens with the Neanderthal people? Like, is there, like, a certain percentage that, like, won't get you into, like...
But is that, like, maybe Ancestry.com isn't tracking Neanderthals. Maybe that's 23andMe. And like the Mormons are like, no, we're all human,
right?
We're all Homo sapiens.
We're all Homo sapiens, but not Homo all sapiens, of us are sapiens. Getting to seventh heaven,
right? Yeah, we're not all going to that other planet. So,
apologies to our Mormon listeners. I don't know if you exist, but
yeah,
please let us know if you are tracking Neanderthal.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be super interesting, and on that note, I guess we'll say goodbye.
That's a good time to end.
Yeah. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.